We haven't quite knocked out this first chapter, but it won't take long to do so. It's just a really kind of an introductory chapter. We were, I think, talking about the distinction between prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells, right? Which are named on the basis of presence or absence of nucleus, but really that's not the whole story. Prokaryotic cells lack membrane-bounded organelles of any type, including the nucleus, but also they don't have things like endoplasmic reticulum or Golgi complex, anything that's membrane-bounded other than the plasma membrane. That's their only membrane in prokaryotes, whereas eukaryotes have all those others. But remember also that there are three domains of life. So eukaryotes and prokaryotes, those are not phylogenetic terms. That's just a dichotomy based on cell type. The three domains of life are archaea, which include only prokaryotes, bacteria, which include the rest of the prokaryotes, and eukarya, which is the one we belong to, of course, that includes all eukaryotic organisms. Well, we're looking at, in slide three, at a cartoon of a plant cell compared to an animal cell. Well, these are both eukaryotic cells, right? So there isn't a bacterium, for instance, for comparison, alas. But the point of this is size. The point of this size slide is to give you an appreciation of the size of things. And typical, there's variation, of course, but typical plant and animal cells are tens of micrometers big. A typical eukaryotic cell is roughly 10 times bigger than a prokaryotic cell in all three dimensions. Therefore, a eukaryotic cell is roughly how many times the volume of a prokaryotic cell? 10 what? 10 to the third. What do we know that 10 to the third of or as? 1,000, right. So about 1,000 times the size, the volume of a typical bacterium, for instance, as a typical prokaryote. There's not shown here. But the point here is cells, it's to talk about sizes of cells, it's appropriate to use micrometers. It's convenient to use micrometers. And we can see individual cells with light microscopy. Most of them are invisible to the naked eye, but they're easily visualized with light microscopes. And you can even see some of the details inside of cells with light microscopes, but not usually very much detail. The macromolecular structures that exist in cells and make up the plasma membrane itself are at the nanometer scale. So those are, you know, this is not the atomic level, but this is the molecular level. And that's why we don't see such fine detail with light microscopy, because light microscopes lack sufficient resolution to actually be able to view things at the nanometer scale. Right, we need electron microscopes to do that. Well, in slide four, we're looking at a logarithmic scale of size here. Appreciate the fact that it's logarithmic scale, not linear. So every time you go up one major tick on this, it's really 10 times bigger than the one below it. It doesn't go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It goes 0.1, 1, 10, 100, and so on, just like the pH scale. If this were a linear scale, it would have to be much bigger, and things would be more spread out. But it shows you that life, living things, or the things that living things are made out of, spans an enormous range of size. And we as humans, with our unaided eyes, can easily visualize things at that top level, down to hundreds of micrometers. So we can actually see certain large individual cells, but those are unusual cells, unusually large. Most cells are best viewed at the cell level, the whole cell level, with light microscopy, as I was saying. But to get in there and really get a look at tiny structures within cells, so subcellular structures, we need the help of electron microscopy. And the reason that electron microscopy gives us better magnification and resolution, well, specifically why it gives us better resolution, is because it's not constrained the same way light microscopy is. A light microscope is called a light microscope because it uses humanly visible light, electromagnetic radiation, that's transmitted through the specimen and then through lenses to magnify that before it enters your eye. Well, any electromagnetic radiation or any light, whether it's visible or not, is wave-like, right? The humanly visible range of wavelengths is roughly 400 to 700 nanometers. And that's what really constrains or puts a limit to the resolution of light microscopy. No matter how good you make the lenses, you still run into a limit of resolution, the ability to resolve individual particles on that slide by the width of the shortest wavelength that our eyes are sensitive to. So it's roughly half of that wavelength, and therefore, it doesn't matter how much time or energy or money you spend on optics, if you use humanly visible light, you have a maximum resolution. Well, electron microscopy doesn't use humanly visible light. It uses electrons, beams of electrons, to view the specimen, and that has a much smaller wavelength, and therefore a much higher resolution. It's able to tell apart much tinier objects than light microscopy does. We still run into a limit there, kind of frustrating, because we would like to clearly see individual atoms. But we're, you know, electron microscopy, even though it gets better and better with techniques, doesn't get all the way down to the smallest atomic level. Slide 5 is just an example slide showing you some pictures of different microscopy techniques. So in light microscope, on a light microscope, you can use bright field microscopy, which means the background is bright compared to the specimen because you're shining light through it. So the field, which means the background, is bright compared to the specimen, compared to dark field microscopy, for instance, which still uses light, but by the way it's bounced around, the specimen itself will be light and the background will be dark. Depends on what you're trying to do. It's also usually beneficial to stain things if you want to look at them, because a typical cell is fairly transparent unless it's a photosynthetic cell, in which case it has pigments. A pigment, by the way, is just anything that absorbs some sort of visible light. That's why pigments look colored to us, because they absorb some of the light that's put onto them and they reflect the rest back to us, or transmit the rest back to us. But that's how photosynthesis works. You have to absorb light in order to get that energy from the light, and that's why photosynthesis involves pigments. But pigments naturally make cells visible to us. Most non-photosynthetic cells, though, don't have very many pigments, and therefore the light just passes through them, and you see kind of a ghost image. So this is why the pictures you see in books are not living cells usually. They're highly modified cells. Techniques of staining allow things to stand out very well, but the staining process kills the cell. So light microscopy is good for seeing things, but it's not necessarily good for seeing living things in action, depending on what you're trying to do. You can also use phase contrast, which uses interference of light waves so that some waves destroy each other, some waves enhance each other, and that drastically increases the contrast, which is why it's called phase contrast. So this is the same image as above, really. Not exactly the same image, but same kind of cells viewed under phase contrast. And things stand out a lot better without actually having to stain them or mess with them, so they could still be alive, in other words. Differential interference contrast is just a modified version of that. Also uses destructive and constructive light interference. But notice that this technique gives it more of a three-dimensional character, which is sometimes nice. Fluorescence microscopy uses fluorescence, which is the emission of light by an excited atom. Right? That's what fluorescence is. If a photon, which is a packet of light energy, it gets absorbed by a material, that energy, I mean that photon gets destroyed. It no longer exists when it gets absorbed. But the energy, of course, does not get destroyed. The energy goes into exciting that atom, which sends an electron of that atom up an energy level, invests it in energy temporarily. But then that is an unstable condition, so that electron quickly goes back down to its lower energy level. And when that happens, the energy once again is not destroyed, so a brand new photon gets created, investing that photon in the energy that's lost when you go back down an energy level, and that photon is emitted from that object. So it is light coming from that actual substance. It glows, in other words. Glowing is fluorescence or phosphorescence. Depends on how quickly it happens. That's the only difference. So this is nice because we can get things to actually shine for us to stand out. That usually involves modifying the cell as well. And a confocal microscope really it is just a modification of that technique using lasers. When a group of cells, which has a thickness to it, parts of them start glowing, you're looking through several levels of depth, and the glowing makes it look fuzzy, basically. A confocal scope uses lasers so that it's lighting up only one thin slice of the overall thickness of the cell at a time. And so the rest of the cell becomes pretty much invisible, and you can look at just a slice of it, kind of like a body scan can nowadays. Those are all techniques of light microscopy. But to see really fine details, like I said, at the nanometer scale, you need an electron microscope. And there are variations on electron microscopes, but there are two main categories. There are transmission electron microscopes, and there are scanning electron microscopes. Transmission electron microscopes are so called because they are pretty analogous to light microscopes, meaning that the electron beam gets transmitted through the specimen. You shine it through the specimen. And the images are kind of analogous to light microscopic images, except with much greater resolution. Scanning electron microscopes bombard the surface of the specimen with electrons that bounce off and get detected. And that's why they're called scanning microscopes. And that is really good if what you want to get a good idea of is the shape of the surface. To do that, though, you have to coat the thing in metal, usually. And so all kinds of electron microscopy involves killing the cell. So you get a very good look at structure, but you can't really observe things in action with electron microscopy. Anyway, these are electron micrographs that we're seeing here as examples. Slide 7, the final slide of the chapter. And this really just is here to remind me to tell you about model organisms, which are used in science all the time. Model organisms are called model organisms because they represent something that you're trying to study in general. But a model organism is a specimen that is a good representative of some group, whether that's physiologically or otherwise, and is also chosen because it's convenient to work with for various reasons. For instance, it might just be easy to maintain. It doesn't die very easily in the lab, or has a very short generation time, because sometimes, you know, especially in genetics, for instance, we want to be able to study several different generations. Well, even if it were ethical to work on humans, you would have to wait a hell of a long time, right, to go through five generations. So that's why it seems like we're always working on the same species over and over. There are people who break out and study other species, of course, but geneticists, for instance, they use Drosophila more than any other organism. The Drosophila are fruit flies. They're easy to work with. They're good for genetic studies. Of course, if you're working with a prokaryote, you don't want to use a eukaryotic cell to study prokaryotes. So there are prokaryotic model organisms. E. coli is famous, right? That's the one on the upper left. Brewer's yeast, or Saccharomyces cerevisiae, that's used as a unicellular eukaryotic model. It's eukaryotic, so it represents us eukarya, but it's unicellular. Now, if you're studying something that's multicellular, though, you, of course, want to have a model organism that's multicellular, like Drosophila or C. elegans, and so on. If you really are concerned about what happens in mammals, since we aren't fellow mammals, you would use a mouse, a famous model organism, and so on. So that's just the point of model organisms. They are good experimental representatives of other groups. So before I switch the recording, any questions on this opening chapter? All right.